Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we're talking about comedies about music. First, we'll chat about the Lonely Island pop star mock documentary, Pop Star Never Stop Never Stopping. And then we'll take a more general look at a genre that's made fun of folk music, rock music, hair bands, and lots more. What makes musicians so deliciously mockable? And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. In any given year, there are more than 100,000 albums released. 100,000! That's nearly 2,000 albums a week. We know it's impossible to keep up with that much music, so NPR's All Songs Considered is here to help. Each week, hosts Bob Boylan and Robin Hilton find the best in new music for you to fall in love with. Subscribe to All Songs Considered now at npr.org/podcasts.
We've got music and comedy on this week's show, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And back from vacation, we missed you, buddy. Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And joining us from Boston is our sometimes contrarian, occasionally egalitarian, Madam Librarian, Margaret Willison. Margaret, what do you do?
Well, as you say, I'm a librarian. I'm also one half of the Two Bossy Dames and one third of the Appointment Television podcast. And the host, I like to say, of the best 24/7 slumber party on Twitter.
That's right. You absolutely are. It's wonderful to have Margaret with us. We went this weekend and saw Pop Star Never Stop Never Stopping.
We were it, actually.
We
pretty
were
much
it.
It.
I think we were the only ones who went. Now, this is an interesting thing because this is a movie that comes from Andy Samberg's comedy little tribe, The Lonely Island, who also have done a whole bunch of digital shorts for Saturday Night Live, going back to Lazy Sunday and a bunch of other stuff. And I think of them as, you know, really popular and, you know, they're big on YouTube. And yet, they put this comedy out. It's very much in the style of the stuff that they do. It has tons of cameos from various people, and very few people went and saw it. I am curious about that.
Well, I'm reminded a little bit of an old Jon Stewart bit when the Real World movie came out. Do you remember the Real World movie?
I remember that there was one.
And it made something like $600,000 at the box office. And Jon Stewart did a little thing and he said, this proves that America is absolutely in love with reality television and willing to pay exactly $0 for it. So maybe it's just a product of people are used to not paying to see this stuff.
I don't know. I was surprised. And I was a little bit bummed out because I have seen way worse and way dumber comedies.
Sure. I mean, I thought it was agreeable. I thought it was funny. I thought it was sweet. I'm not going to kick the puppy. I mean, this is like a very...
or the turtle.
Or the turtle, for example. And it's also, let's point out, 86 minutes long. An 86-minute-long comedy.
Yeah, we appreciate that.
But that said, I wasn't sure that I wanted to go see it in a theater. And in that, I agreed with most of America. But it was never going to be a blockbuster. It was never even going to be Pitch Perfect or Bridesmaids. It was always going to be a thing that they got rewatched in a lot of dorm rooms and vape stores across the country.
It's MacGruber. If you're talking about the collective wattage of all the star power in this movie, all of the incredibly famous people that they got to do like little walk-on gags, it is maybe the highest concentration of famous people making cameos in any movie of the last 5 years that do not include either Key or Peele.
Yeah, it's true. So let's talk about some of the people who are in this movie. Well, first we'll say, in this movie, Andy Samberg plays a guy who is a pop star who used to be in a kind of a, it's somewhere between like a boy band and a white rap group. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of a mush together of those
things. The Style Boys.
The Style Boys. And he has now gone off on his own and become an extremely successful solo artist. And now he is going to release his second album. And the documentary follows the release of his second album and his tour. Some of the people who appear in this movie, not only the other guys from Lonely Island, but also Tim Meadows is the manager. Will Forte is a bagpiper. Mm-hmm. I'm just doing them in the order that they come into my mind.
Imogen Poots.
Imogen Poots.
Maya Rudolph, Sarah Silverman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are Will Arnett in a very... odd part. I
yes.
Thought.
Yeah. Mike Birbiglia also.
And Mike Birbiglia and Chelsea Peretti in that same. Yeah.
And Eric Andre.
A little bit.
We're just gonna list the whole
this
rest of the
podcast.
This
is what we're
going to
do.
Just going to read the IMDb
people.
Page.
But the point is, there are a lot of funny people in it. And I think the movie is funny. It is in part a Bieber parody, no?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I think we need to come up with a name. At least I originally thought we need to come up with a name for the kind of cameo that happens in this movie. Your friends over at Television Without Pity came up with the notion of, hey, it's that guy.
Yes.
And I like that, but that is value neutral. It is a statement of fact. I think that these cameos are different. There's something that happens, and it's happening more and more, when everything you think you know about a performer lines up so well with the sensibility of the film that they're cameoing in, you just grin. You are delighted yeah. to see them. There is a fundamental difference between Justin Timberlake in yeah. Popstar and Justin Bieber in Zoolander 2. Because there's a pre-existing relationship between Justin Timberlake and these guys.
Right.
And it feels like he's in on it.
Oh, yeah.
I am not convinced that Justin Bieber is convinced. And it's also less hip. It's a stiffer thing. They're both theoretically parodying their image, setting up their image, or at least that's what Justin Bieber's publicist would have you believe. But I don't feel it. But
you
I feel
it
here.
With Timberlake.
Totally
I think
Timberlake.
Timberlake's funny in this movie. He plays the personal chef of Connor For Real, as his name is.
Mm-hmm.
Did this movie work for you, Miss Margaret Wilson?
I enjoyed it while I was watching it, and I don't think I will ever see it again. It was great. It was just light and forgettable.
Yep.
And I think, in fairness to the movie, if I had gone in, I'd seen a lot of really, really strong reviews from people whose opinions I would trust on Twitter, saying that it was like the Spinal Tap for pop music. And so I might have had like too high a bar for it.
Sure.
Fair enough. How about you, Thompson?
I thought it worked great. I think it does suffer from a very common malady in comedies like this, where the first half is just absolutely stuffed to the gills with jokes. The second half, they have to go through the machinations of resolving the plot.
An arc.
And, the plot is like, there is not a surprise anywhere at any point in this plot. You are not
That plot is really the point of this movie.
plot is just the skeleton on which they hang jokes, and it could not be more perfunctory. Once they have to kind of grind the gears of resolving it, the movie slows down, I think, in the second half. But there's so much joke density, particularly early on. And I will always say about satire, if you're satirizing music, if you're satirizing TV, if you're satirizing movies, you have to be prepared to do what you are satirizing as good as or better than the source material. So you've got to have people who are writing really, really strong songs. And we'll talk about this in the second segment on this show. These songs, some are funnier than others, but they are really crisply and very, very well executed. Probably my favorite would be the clearly digging at Macklemore song, Equal Rights. We need equality and for all to see that this is the new way. Not gay, it just seems not gay, wrong, not gay, that no one seems to care. Sports, we can't continue to pretend this not gay madness has to end. Not gay. I was born this way. Straight. You were born your way. Gay. Gay or straight, straight or gay, it's all okay. Sure. It's time to make a change. Yes.
Yeah.
Very, 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 very funny bit. And so, you know, there are just funny bits scattered throughout the movie and recurring jokes that worked for me. And I just grinned and laughed out loud a whole bunch of times. I think this movie's going to have a longer shelf life in the world than it does in theaters.
Right. I think it's useful to compare this to 2007's Hot Rod, which was the first film made by the Lonely Island guys, in which Andy Samberg played a stunt guy surrounded by, you know, people, and there was a plot of, you know, father issues and stuff like that. There was a piece on MTV.com a couple of weeks ago by Teo Bugbee, who pointed out that they got that film right after Lazy Sunday. And critics said, this is good for 5 minutes. It feels like a herky-jerky film. It's good for 5 minutes at a time.
Yeah.
I would argue that comedies tend to be good for 5 minutes at a time because laughter is a release. You have to build up and then you release. So, but going back to watch it, it was much more surreal, much stupider, aggressively stupider. And that film was produced by Lorne Michaels. And one can convince oneself that this film, Popstar, which was co-produced by, among other people, Judd Apatow, has the Apatow footprint. I mean, not in terms of length, but in terms of...
I was just going to say.
But in terms of this worry that we've got to keep this guy sincere, likable, He can do horrible things, like, say, in the Anne Frank house, but he's got to be winning and agreeable. You can't alienate the audience. And I think that makes this film feel more circumscribed, circumspect, a little safer, in places where I expected it to go bigger.
Yeah, I think what Andy Samberg has been doing since he left Saturday Night Live, to me, is making sure that he's not Adam Sandler. And right. I think the reason what that comes down to for me is Adam Sandler has a tendency to play guys who, for me in movies, seem aggressively unlikable. Mm-hmm. And no matter how much they are maybe redeemed at the end, or they get together with the ex-wife or whoever it is that they've been warring with, or I assume they make up with all the friends in Grown Ups 2, although have I seen it? I have not. He has never been an appealing screen presence for me. And I think Andy Samberg, maybe not consciously, seems to me to have said, okay, look, I have been this goofball on SNL, but I don't want to be him and I don't want to be Rob Schneider. I want to be able to play real guys. If you look at Celeste and Jesse Forever, which is the movie that he did with Rashida Jones, which, by the way, is very good. And I've said that
Linda
on
and I
before.
Both love it passionately.
He plays a real guy in that movie, and he would not be able to make that movie if he had given up kind of to the idea of playing super broad, goofy kind of bros in a bad way. And the same is true of Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Yeah.
He's a fundamentally likable guy on that show. And you do make a sacrifice when you do that, right? Because you commit yourself to do stories where it's always going to come back around to the fact that you're fundamentally a good guy. I agree with you that this movie might be funnier if he weren't fundamentally a good guy. But part of his persona and what always gets me is that sort of he always is, ultimately.
Well, and he has outlets for that big, over-the-top style. He's been very, very successful as an animated voice actor, where he gets to yell a lot more. It's still a pretty big, broad part. I mean, there's still a lot
of
juicy opportunities to be incredibly silly.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm responding to to Glenn's sort of, the point of the movie is not his destruction, right? And I think that that's consistent with what he's doing in other roles that I've seen him in. I don't think he's interested in the version of this movie that could exist where ultimately you leave him face down in a gutter. Now, I want to raise one other small point. Small point about comedies. Small point. I would like to see one comedy that does not have the look how much weed this is joke because I'm so tired of it.
Yeah.
It's so boring. It's not that funny. It's a joke people think is funny when they're smoking a lot of weed.
No,
I cast no aspersions on the writing of this movie, but my feeling is if you have not been smoking a lot of weed is not that funny.
I agree completely, co-signed. However, that said, this movie compensates to me. I will put that on one side of the scale, and on the other side of the scale, we will talk about the album release system in which they agree to have their music piped through all of a certain brand of appliances, Wi-Fi system, so people have to hear his album every time they open the refrigerator.
Weed versus Wi-Fi, which is of course, the takeoff on the Apple.
On YouTube.
Putting YouTube on everybody's...
Sure.
That just made me laugh and laugh.
In the case of the songs, do you think that those songs were smarter than these guys? Like, that these guys would write those songs? I mean, yes, not gay.
I think they would write Civil Rights. I think they would write the Donkey Roll.
Let me see that Donkey Roll.
Yeah.
The Bin Laden one.
The Bin Laden one has a build to it that is a really good comedy build that seems like if you were these guys, you wouldn't necessarily know.
Well, they wouldn't be able to write it as comedy.
Yeah,
like, they're not writing it as comedy.
Yeah.
I think I see Glenn's point that there's a structural build to the Bin Laden song that is not there in, say, Incredible Thoughts, the finale song, which seems very plausibly them and also very successful as a comedy bit. Whereas there's a trajectory, there's like a dismantling of the story as it's being told in the Bin Laden song that might be, I agree, Glenn.
I actually think this movie is going to have legs. I think this movie is MacGruber. I think this movie is Josie and the Pussycats. I think this movie...
Josie and the Pussycats.
I think this is a movie that is flopping in theaters, but was not really really is not really best served by playing in theaters.
Right.
I think this
the kind
thing,
of movie that might eventually just be a VOD movie.
This, yeah, I think that it's going to be well received in a way where it kind of sticks in the firmament a little bit longer than you would expect, a way that you would expect a movie that makes however much money this thing is going to wind up making to do.
Yeah,
Jorma Taccone is really good in this.
Yeah, I agree.
He's giving you a layer to this. Yeah, this is very sweet, but also a real pathos and an empathy that I didn't necessarily expect.
Yeah.
And again, smaller choices that surprised and actually enriched.
I did root for him most of all in that band. I also particularly enjoyed the running gag of the like dead mouse helmet that they have him wear that emits a gigantic beam of light and a foghorn. Really, really, really funny.
Yeah. Well, normally I say at this point in the show, I'll be eager to hear what so many of you think about this movie. I'm telling you, we thought it was funny. I think it's really funny. I recommend if you feel like a giggle, and who doesn't feel like a giggle?
That's right.
I ask you. I liked it. I think we mostly liked it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
We mostly enjoyed it.
I highly recommend this movie.
It's effervescent. Uh-huh. It's here.
This is a great way to spend $10 and stay in air conditioning for an hour and a half.
There you go. Margaret's bringing up the air conditioning argument, always relevant at this time
Amazing.
Of year. Come find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet at us at PCHH and let us know what you think. So we are sort of using this movie as a way into a bigger, such as it is, question. Which is comedies about music. We got talking about the way that they are constantly making goofy movies about bands and singers. So when we come right back, we're going to talk about that.
Let's take a moment to thank and share a message from our sponsor, Airbnb. When you travel with Airbnb, you can live in over 2 million homes around the world. You don't have to experience a city like a tourist. Don't go to Paris to wait in lines. Don't go to LA to take a bus tour. And don't go to Tokyo to pose for the same photos. Paint the view from your host's garden. Wake up to the sunrise on a houseboat. Or have someone ask you for directions. Feel at home, explore your host's neighborhood, and truly experience a city. Live there, even if it's just for a night. Airbnb.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before the break, we were talking about the movie Pop Star, Never Stop, Never Stopping. We are here with Margaret Willison in Boston and Glenn and Stephen and me here in D.C. And now we want to talk a little bit about comedies about music because Pop Star is part of a big tradition of not only very specific things like mock documentaries about comedy, but the whole idea that people find bands and singers and performers kind of funny. So we wanted to talk a little bit about that. Stephen, you're kind of our music guy. Mm-hmm. Do you have a classic in this genre? I have a feeling I know what you're going to say, but do you have a favorite?
Yeah, I almost don't even want to talk about This Is Spinal Tap because it's such the obvious, you know, like the pitch up the middle. But it is probably the most important film in this genre. It
directed by Rob Reiner, starring a bunch of brilliant 80s movie stars of comedy.
And it's where you have the kind of Christopher Guest troupe. You know, forming, you know, the you have your Harry Shearer and your Michael McKean and your Christopher Guest. Anyway, it is an absolutely wonderful film. It's one of those movies where you are absolutely required to see it for the first time when you're 12, 13, 14 years old and then to quote it.
Do you think current 12, 13, 14 year olds understand the genre being parodied there all that well?
Okay, so it is great for people who are emotionally have been 12, 13 years old for 30 years.
Does the idea of like the hairband?
You know, I showed this movie to my kids, and they definitely responded well to it, and in part, I'm sure, because of my enthusiasm, but also because they'd been playing a lot of Guitar Hero, and were certainly familiar. I mean, rock and roll of the variety that you hear in Spinal Tap is not ubiquitous right now at all, and so kids are not necessarily exposed to it, except through their parents' car radios, maybe.
Yeah.
But I think there's enough outsized silliness in that movie that it still holds up extremely well. And you have, I mean, there are so many catchphrases that are catchphrases for a reason. But I mean, I think when we talk about why is this type of movie funny? Why are musicians funny? Spinal Tap has it all. It's puncturing delusions. It's a very familiar rise and fall story. It's an arc that people really understand. And any time you can put that together with a soundtrack of, in this case, hilarious songs that really do stand on their own divorced from the rest of the movie, you have that kind of complete 360 experience. Yeah. Like a great, you have such an opportunity to create a soundtrack that people are excited
about. Yeah, and I would argue, I would posit.
I would say.
I would say that Sex Farm is closer to being a real song than the Bin Laden song.
That's
is.
It.
Yes. Yes.
Big Bottom is certainly.
Those songs are not smarter than those guys.
One of my favorite things about Spinal Tap is that it's not just these heavy metal songs. It's also their songs from early in their career, like Listen to What the Flower People Say, Cups and Cakes.
Cups and cakes, cups and cakes. Please make sure that nothing breaks. The china's so dear and the treacle so clear. And I'm glad that you are here.
Like these beautiful, very specific parodies. I'll get to A Mighty Wind in a second. Yeah. But it shows that these guys are interested when they're writing these songs. They don't just want to parody one kind of music. They've got their eye on a bunch of other kinds of
music. Yeah, and I can pivot away from this movie temporarily to kind of widen out. Because just this last weekend as we're taping this, Michael McCain, on his website, michaelmccain.com, wrote a thing about making Spinal Tap the movie and posted a lot of new photographs from that time, but also told several stories from it, from the actual making of the film. And at one point he said, as they were trying to come up with the what the film was, he said, "We watched a lot of rock and roll concert and documentary film and noted the recurrence of an interesting theme, the survivor, the yeoman road warrior who never says die, no matter how clearly the market suggests he do so." Now, this is that genre, right? It's not man versus self. It's not man versus nature. It's man versus relevance.
Yeah.
It's about pop music is about man versus the fickle collective mindset, because that's a genre that is powered by burning musicians for fuel.
Yeah, of course. True.
And so it's not just right. This genre. It's really of course it's Walk Hard, it's Mighty Wind, it's every behind the music that's ever been on VH1. It's every Where Are They Now segment on some blog or local news thing. Mm-hmm. But it's also non-comedies about music, right? The non-comedy Country Strong, which is a non-comedy by intention, but what turns out to be, this is the one where Gwyneth Paltrow plays a down-home country girl who makes good.
Uh-huh.
The reason that becomes so funny is because of how assiduously and with what dogged determination it steers into the cliche skid. Like, you know everything that's going to happen in this film.
Yeah.
The question, the only question, is how is it going to happen? And the answer, invariably, is bigger than necessary. Larger, turned up on the volume. So that's the story of this genre, the story of many of anything to do with music. You're talking about this white-knuckled quest to stay relevant.
That's true, not just in this Christopher Guest world of this is Spinal Tap and not musicians exactly, but Waiting for Guffman and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It's also true of a lot of other comedies about musicians. If you look at even something like the Blues Brothers, or you look at like School of Rock,
or if you look at Josie and the Pussycats,
of course,
also, which is literally built around the conceit. Like the boy band at the start of that movie is called Du Jour,
right? And I think all of these, even before you get to kind of current pop music and Bieber and Du Jour and all that stuff, there is a long-standing fascination with the idea of kind of rock dudes as kind of the ultimate Apatovian guy who needs to grow up, but at the same time is doggedly chasing this dream. Movies tend to use music, the desire to make music, as their most common stand-in for I got a dream.
Right.
Sure.
It's a very common shorthand. I mean, think about all the characters. I mean, even outside of comedy, think of all the characters who the reason why you're supposed to think this person is so sensitive is that they can play the piano.
Guarantee you do not want to pursue that throughout your life.
So the noble mope.
The noble mope. Who invariably, like, yes, some of them are poets, but Most commonly, I would say they play the guitar or the piano.
I just want to go back to something that, was dropped too quickly. Margaret, can we talk about Josie and the Pussycats?
Oh my God, any day, Stephen. Because I've been wanting to do.
This movie has been recommended to me for years and years and years. My AV club gang loves this movie. And I have meant to watch it since it came out in the year 2001. Finally got around to watching it today.
It's so good.
And it is burbling around my...
Remind me of some details about this movie.
Well, there's this band. They're called Josie and the Pussycats.
What? Long tails, ears for hats, guitars, sharps and flats. The tone is neat. Sweet. Groovy.
Now, Margaret... So now that we've got you caught up, Margaret and I can speak to this movie. And this movie, to me, is a really noble entry in the canon of movies that have no right to be any good.
I want to point out, Stephen just said, Josie and the Pussycats is a noble entry in the canon. Go ahead.
It's
sort of the way the Lego movie has no right to be good, because it's a Lego movie. Mm-hmm. This is an Archie Comics spinoff that they take in a completely different direction from what you expect and is about, and takes several meta steps away from what you think it's going to be.
Does it really?
Yes, really.
What steps does it take away from what I think it is?
Product placement is used to such a degree that it becomes a visual satirical joke in literally every scene that they're in. The engine of the movie is that the pop music has been repurposed to sell consumerism to teenagers and brainwash them. And that is used to great and terrific comedic effect. Parker Posey and Alan Cumming play the heavies perfectly.
All right,
I'm looking at Glenn here.
Glenn,
you're going to like
and
this
the
movie.
The boy band du jour is played by Brecken Meyer.
Seth Green. Oh, now I'm in.
And Donald Faison.
Oh.
And they have an incredible, incredible triumphant arc throughout the movie that you don't entirely see coming. Also, their hit single is called Backdoor Lover, and it is exactly what you think it is.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
It's such a good, underrated, funny, terrific movie, and Tara Reid is fantastic in it.
Wow.
Yeah, the actual band is Rachel Lee Cook from She's All That, Rosario Dawson, and Tara Reid. So you have these songs, which among other things are actually, the vocals are performed by Kay Hanley, who's the lead singer of Letters to Cleo. And they are written by, yes, many of them are written by Adam Duritz from Counting Crows. But of course, many of them are produced by, several of them are written by, his DNA is swirling around in all these songs, Adam Schlesinger.
Who is John
and all things.
Of Fountains of Wayne, who wrote That Thing You Do, the song That Thing You Do, which is a masterpiece of pop songwriting,
and
who wrote a bunch of songs in Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
And in Music and Lyrics, which is one that I was going to talk about, because Music and Lyrics...
Ooh, that's such a good one.
Right. So Music and Lyrics, which is the movie that I will stand up for, that many people, not enough people will tell you that it is a noble entry in the canon, but I will tell you that it is a noble entry in the canon of rom-com. And... this is the one that is about Hugh Grant as essentially Andrew Ridgely from Wham. Not George Michael from Wham. Andrew Ridgely from Wham. And right down to the fact that there's a very whammy
ballad. Pop Goes My Heart.
Not Pop Goes My Heart. The ballad, which sounds exactly like Wham ballads. Like Careless Whisper sounded and all that stuff. And as Stephen said, Adam Schlesinger did not write all of the music in that, but he wrote some of it. And that is a movie where, because you believe not only the kind of openly funny music, like the stuff that the song that Margaret mentioned, Pop Goes My Heart, which is supposed to be their pop hit, it sounds exactly like a very legit pop hit. And it has a very legit 80s video. Very legit. It's not just that, but then they write, he meets Drew Barrymore and she waters the plants and then they fall in love. Anyway, so the point is, they then have to write a new pop song. And their new pop song, A, is believable, and B, is good. All I want to do is find a way back into love. I can make it through without a way back into love. And if I open my heart again, I guess I'm hoping.
I did watch A Mighty Wind over the weekend, mm-hmm. and that is a subgenre of this which is taking something very, very, very specific mm-hmm. and trying to nail every corner of something that is not currently in the marketplace.
Which is
late 60s folk music of a certain variety, not
of, the Weavers. It's really parodying a documentary called The Weavers Wasn't That a Time. You can tell how much of the DNA of that is in.
Which, by the way, is a great documentary. Yeah. I'm just going to tell you.
But when people think about, you know, 60s folk music, they're thinking about Bob Dylan. They're mm-hmm. thinking about this very heavy, serious
right.
stuff.
And they're this not is, thinking about the Kingston Trio.
This
right.
is much more Peter, Paul, and Mary, Kingston Trio. But like also tweer mm-hmm. and sillier and it's interesting because that movie's a little slower than I would have liked. They take their time with it, but you have that entire Christopher Guest army of hilarious people, including Parker Posey, as we mentioned before. But you know, it's mm-hmm. got the great John Michael Higgins being mm-hmm. especially John Michael Higginsy and mm-hmm. awesome. I guess what I like about it, in addition to getting the songs right, it just gets the specificity of what these people would be like.
Yeah. I want to push back a little on something that you said earlier about, you know, oh, they can just play the piano, oh, they can just play the guitar. I think one reason that I react to this genre more than I should as somebody who is completely non-musical is because I'm completely non-musical. If it's a sports comedy, then it's a sports doofus. And I understand what's involved in having to do sports in theory. But music is deeply mysterious to me. I know it's more than just, you know, like math and muscle memory. There is something ineffable. I certainly can't eff it. I mean, 5 years of piano lessons, and none of it stuck, and it's all mysterious to me. So, when I see a comedy person playing music, like the comedy doof who is filled with hubris or whatever, and he can do a thing that I couldn't do in the world, that has a different layer to me. In one sense, yeah. it distances me from them. Because in a lot of comedies, you're smarter and better at than the person you're watching.
Right. Right.
Like mm-hmm. Three Stooges. Like, right. you're better than them.
Right.
And in this thing, there's this one sliver of their life where they theoretically excel. And I would also argue that with music, you don't have to have the cutaway shots of people nodding going, oh, that's good, to show how...
That is the point I wanted to make, too.
Yeah, because music reacts. You know what works. You know what's right. good. It's not technical. It's emotional. And so, therefore, go ahead, right. Margaret. Pick up on what I just said.
I wanted to elaborate and say that that's how it also sets apart. I mean, one of the things that these movies puncture is the kind of inherent absurdity of the creative process, which is oftentimes these almost very dumb people who are being encouraged to take themselves very, very seriously. Mm-hmm. And that's inherently funny, that dynamic. But why this with music is so much more successful is because you can make a very funny song that is also musically successful. And the process of watching a song be played, listening to a song, is fun in a way that the process of watching a bad comedy sketch or a mediocre movie is not, which is why maybe A Mighty Wind is so successful, or I find it so artistically successful, whereas Christopher Guest's movie about movies for your consideration really just for me.
Yeah, I think there's an interesting distinction between movies about musicians who are successful, or at least who are successful for a while, like Spinal Tap and like Popstar, and movies that are about strivers, like School of Rock and the Blues mm-hmm. Brothers and mm-hmm. stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Because what you get in Spinal Tap and what you get in Popstar is in part comedy that is based on the taking down of yeah. the person. Mm-hmm. The funniest sequence to me in This is Spinal Tap is where they are playing kind of smaller and smaller venues, and you feel it dying, and they don't really yeah. want to talk about it, and they're sort of, I mean, everybody kind of doesn't know when to start admitting that it's ending,
puppet, or at least puppet show and Spinal Tap.
At least that it's not going well at the moment. And there's some of that in Popstar too, because mm-hmm. you know, he has his tour, but when he releases his album, it's not instantly successful. People do not gravitate toward his Marriage Equality song. Mm-hmm. Spoiler alert. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that can be really fun is a movie about kind of that process of downfall, always with some empathy. There's always some empathy there, as opposed to a movie about somebody who's never made it, mm-hmm. who maybe will never make it. Like if you watch School of Rock, School of Rock's not necessarily about the fact that he's going to be a rock star. Right. It's not necessarily about the fact that he's now going to go and be, you know, the biggest rock star in the world. It's about finding something that's meaningful to do with your life that is connected to music. Is that making sense?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. I will be, again, curious to hear what some of you think about your favorite comedies about music, comedies about musicians. Come and find us on Facebook or tweet at us at PCHH and tell us what you think. When we come back, it is going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So stick around.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and the following message comes from Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo understands that you work hard to get the most out of life. From starting a business to saving for retirement, there are a lot of things you want to accomplish. Working together, Wells Fargo will take the time to understand what you're trying to achieve, to help you reach your financial goals. That way you can care for the people and things that matter most. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/together. Wells Fargo. Together we'll go far.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
By the time this episode drops, we will have finally launched the first episode of a Facebook Live project that Barry Hardiman and I have been working on together. We don't know how frequently we're going to do it. We don't know if we'll ever do another one, but we are recording a show that we are tentatively calling Won't Somebody Please Think of the Children, in which she and I sit down and discuss the intersection of pop culture and parenting, which is a topic that we have covered on this show several times. We're, you know, bringing in book recommendations. We're talking about music. I will tell a story that I've probably told on the show about how I get babies to sleep. It is a fun opportunity to do a little low stakes, low effort, no cost little mini program with a dear, dear friend of the show. We will throw a link up to our first episode on the blog. We are tentatively and willing to change this, calling it Won't Somebody Please Think of the Children.
I like the name.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Two things. The day after this episode drops on Saturday, June 11th, here in Washington, D.C., y'all can have dinner with me and a guy by the name of Trey, how would you pronounce that? Graham. At his dining cocktails and conversation series called In Good Company. We will have a three-course meal. There'll be cocktails. There'll be me yammering about my damn book. And the meal will be prepared by a chef here from D.C. called Chris Beasley. It's going to charge you a chunk of money, $60 to $85, but a percentage of the profits will be going to the Hero Initiative, which is an excellent nonprofit that supports older comics creators who may need, and in many cases because they got no insurance when they were doing all this work for hire, may need medical or financial assistance. So you can get the tickets at Eventbrite, that's Brite.com. Just do a search for my name or Trey's name or Batman, and I bet it'll come up.
Yep. This is a very much a family event. Yes. Steven's lovely partner, Katie Presley, works at the place where they're doing this, and everybody's kind of, you know,
but in the... As an added selling point, Katie and I are going to be out of town and will not be there.
Okay.
So adjacent, but not present.
Yes.
What
yes.
could be better? All right, go ahead, Glenn.
The other thing is 2 weeks ago, as we tape this on Saturday Night Live, on their weekend update section, Maya Rudolph appeared as ousted Brazilian leader Dilma Rousseff, and it is magical.
Could you just explain for us why your government wants to impeach you?
Oh, it's same, Bill. Culamba. The boat it has a hole. I cook the book to hide the hole. Now everybody say, take a hike, you are muito bad presidente. But for me, it's no problems. I go to the beach, okay? I make relax. I drink caipirinha, enjoy guaraná, moqueque de camarão, feijoada, brigadoro, bolacha, patutu, patata, pacaca, yam, yam, yam.
Now, on one level, it's just a funny accent, right? Yeah, but on one level, the Guernica is just some paint. So this is masterful. She is so precise. Her timing is impeccable. She's doing that thing where she's not looking at cue cards, or if she is disguising it so well. It is so funny and so specific and so her. It's got some solid jokes. So seek that out. Maya Rudolph, Dilma Rousseff, SNL.
Very nice. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. All right, Margaret H. Willison, the H stands for Hula Hoop. Hula Hoop, tell me what is making you happy this week, lady.
boy, I have a bunch of things to run down.
Don't you always?
Don't I always? We've got number one. So my ongoing obsession with musical theater has continued to re-blossom. And I have a couple of points on that one I want to point out. So one, the show Hadestown at New York Theater Workshop. It is a really stunning folk opera by the musician Aeneas Mitchell, retelling the Orpheus and Eurydice myth. And all I can tell you is the staging by Rachel Chavkin is stunning. She's a really remarkable director. If you can get tickets before its run closes on July 3rd, do, because it's just a remarkable experience and there isn't a bad seat in the house. So there's that. If you cannot get to New York for tickets, you can listen to the album that Aeneas recorded in 2010 with musicians like Bon Iver and Annie DeFranco, which is great, although not, now I have to say, as good as the live Broadway cast. I also got a chance to see She Loves Me, a Broadway production based on the play Perfumery, which was also made into the movie The Shop Around the Corner and also made into the movie You've Got Mail.
That's right.
Starring Laura Benanti, Zachary Levi, and Jane Krakowski.
Zachary Levi!
And that is square as anything and absolutely perfect.
Very good.
That's running through July 10th. And Waitress, which I've talked about before, is now on Broadway. And more importantly, for most listeners of the show, the live cast recording is now available for purchase at your favorite streaming or record store.
Very good, very good.
And then I just wanted to throw out a mention of issue of my newsletter that I just published a week ago now. My editor and I, we do long takes on things that interest us. And this time we wrote about anger. And I think it turned out really nicely. And more importantly, we've been getting a lot of really, really insightful feedback at the hashtag NormalizeLadyRage. So I would encourage you guys to go read the feedback we've gotten at that hashtag and share some of your experience of being a woman in the world and experiencing anger. Because despite the fact that I seem super sunny, sometimes I get really mad about things. And trying to explain that discrepancy to people is exhausting.
Normalize Lady Rage. Thank you very much, Hula Hoop Willison. I got several on my list this week, too. I'm just going to tell you straight off. One is the return of Angie Tribeca, which as we tape this is coming back tonight. So by the time you hear this, the first episode will be out. Angie Tribeca is the very slapsticky, extremely silly comedy starring Rashida Jones and a bunch of other very funny people. TBS. Check it out. Find it. It's hard to find. It's hard to find the TBS comedies, but it's really worth it. It's goofy if you like Airplane and Police Squad and all that stuff. Speaking of Airplane and Police Squad and all that stuff, here's a transition. There's an absolutely stunning documentary about O.J. Simpson that's coming up. Yeah. This Saturday, so the day after this airs, I believe, is when the first part airs on ABC. It is a 5-part, 7.5-hour documentary. I think we're going to cover it on the show, so I'm not going to say anything else about it. I saw it this weekend. It's amazing. It is so good. So it's called OJ Made in America, so watch for it. Third, news today, AMC is developing David Carr's memoir, Night of the Gun, with David Carr to be played by Bob Odenkirk, which I wouldn't have come up with if you had asked me to brainstorm it, but when you say it, it sounds perfect. It sounds exactly right. And he is working on developing it with Sean Ryan, who is the creator of The Shield and Terriers and a lot of really good television. I'm super optimistic about what that project might lead to. So I was very happy to hear that news. And then also, this weekend, I watched Wiener, the documentary about Anthony Wiener. Now, when we were sitting here talking about the part of Spinal Tap where everything's going wrong and nobody can figure out how to get everybody to understand that it's over, there's a part in Wiener that's exactly like that. There's literally a part where I was sitting here while we were having that discussion thinking, what did I just watch that has that scene that's exactly like that? And I was like, oh, it wasn't a movie. It was Wiener. It really makes you think, what made him think a documentary was a good idea?
The first lapse in judgment in his career.
What you should do is you should watch it, and then we should have coffee, and we'll talk about it. And then I have one more thing before I go. It's so important to me. I did a thing for Weekend Edition, as you taped this almost 2 weeks ago, where I got to play some Stephen Sondheim. And the reason why that is amazing is that our friend, Ari Shapiro, came to my desk so that Ari and I could test each other on how fast we can spit Sondheim lyrics at each other, which might have been the best thing that has ever happened to me. And as I said on Twitter, is fan fiction for a very specific kind of NPR person.
And me?
And I'm just telling you, it really happened, and it was wonderful, and I love my NPR family so very much.
Yeah.
So that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, and Glenn at G.H. Weldon. You can follow Margaret Hula Hoop Willison at Mrs. Friday Next. That's M-R-S Friday Next. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica _ Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T. ZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Hula Hoop, and thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.
Check out the NPR One app for your phone. You can use it to listen to Pop Culture Happy Hour, and it's a great way to find tons of new shows and stories, too. Great hand-curated podcasts and stories are always ready when you are on NPR One. Find it in your app store now at NPR One.